recovering geek. So I'm not just a geek, but I'm, you know, in the phases of recovery from being a geek. You know, I have some brilliant people that are creating all this, and they're like, oh, we could do this, we could do that. I'm like, no, let's just keep it simple.
Hello and welcome to episode 70 of Great Things with Great Tech, the podcast highlighting companies doing great things with great technology. My name's Anthony Spiteri, and in this episode, we're exploring the world of disaster recovery and business continuity with a leader in managed IT services, disaster recovery and business continuity services. That company is Continuity Centers, and I'm joined by Greg Talone, the CEO of Continuity Centers. Welcome to the show, Greg.
Thank you, Anthony. Thanks for having me.
Excellent. So, hey, Greg, just before we dive into the unique approach that you guys do in terms of DR with your cloud IBR, I just want to give a shout out to the show. So if you love great things with great tech and would like to feature in future episodes, you can click on the link on the show notes or go to GTWGT and register your interest. This is a reminder, all episodes of GTWGT are available on all good podcasting platforms, Google, Apple, Spotify, all hosted and distributed by Spotify Podcasts. And as a final reminder, head to YouTube, go to @GTWGTPodcast, hit the like and subscribe button, and you'll get all of these episodes coming and past. Now, with that out of the way, Greg, let's talk about yourself firstly and a really interesting life in IT. All the way back from when you were 12, you were telling me, but you know, we'll get to Continuity Centers a little bit later on and what that company does, but I'm really intrigued in what you were doing at 12 years old, making money in IT.
Sure. So when I turned about 12, I got my first, back then it was an Apple IIe, and a buddy of mine around the corner, he was a computer geek like me. We started soldering chips in to upgrade memory. We were doing things that, you know, completely voided the manufacturer warranty, but we knew we could build stuff. So we learned a lot about, you know, how the circuit boards worked, how technology worked. And then around 12 years old is when I started ordering parts from, I think it was a company called JD Micro Devices. It was basically a physical book that you would look through. This is, you know, way pre the internet. Yeah. And you'd go through the book, we'd order all the parts and we'd assemble them. And I'd sell them actually to, well, friends and family, but my dad, who is a sergeant in the NYPD, had whole bunch of cop friends who all wanted to buy computers because, you know, technology was going to be the next big thing. And I sold, you know, dozens of these IBM clones, you know, to the NYPD officers that were friends with my dad, which was really cool.
Wow, that's pretty cool. Like at 12 years old, that's, you know, I thought I started early. Like I was doing similar things, probably, I guess, you know, I think we're about what we would call a school generation behind, about 5 years different in age. And I was selling computers when I was out of high school to my high school friends, you know, selling IBM clones and in those sort of early days of the internet in 97, but this was even before then. And I guess the difference there is that those PCs you were getting, you're right, like you just wouldn't have gone into a PC shop to get the parts that were quite nice, the motherboard, the sound card, whatever it was. You were ordering these clone parts off a magazine, which is pretty crazy. Yeah. What systems were they? Were they 286s at the time, or what sort of generation of PC were they?
Yeah, 8086s and 286s. So it would be the late 80s is when I started doing that. So about 86, 87. So basically you were buying, you know, 64K worth of RAM. And it was like, I think it was nine chips, eight chips plus one for parity, I think it was. And you had to actually plug them in. And, you know, each chip was an individual just to get 64K. It was not a turnkey solution by all means.
And you realize some people today just don't even know what it is to actually install a bit of memory onto a computer, let alone, you know, 64K and 8 bits with a parity chip. Like, it's crazy how things were. And we sometimes forget, everything's such a black box these days. We forget what it was like back in those days. But okay, so you're doing these things at 12. Like, did you quit school because you were selling so many computers, or what was the thing then?
Eventually, but not at that age. So I did go to high school. So in high school, I would actually take the bus to this guy's house who lived in the same town as me, and he ran a business out of his house. that built and sold PCs. And he had, you know, big customers. They were buying 20 to 50 to 100 PCs at a time. So I would take the bus after school, go to his house, work for, you know, a 4-hour shift, assembling PCs, troubleshooting, installing the OS, you know, doing board level repair. People brought their PC to his house to get fixed. So I did that for most of high school. And then went to another company towards the end of high school where I was doing the same thing, but now in an actual commercial building, assembling. I actually started in the shipping department because he didn't know how much I knew. And within a few months, you know, I was basically helping the techs but do stuff. And they were, you know, they were all at least 30 years old, which was, you know, old back then. I was, you know, 16, 17.
Oh, very old, yeah.
Yeah, they were all old people. But it was cool because I got to work with a lot of different people at such a young age. That's when I went to college for 1 year, NYIT, the New York Institute of Technology. And I didn't really love it. They were teaching one of the classes, I think it was COBOL. And I was like, what's a COBOL? And I was like, I've been working with PCs, you know, for 7 years now, and I've never heard of COBOL. So they were a little bit outdated at the time. So that was about 1991. I would say they were a little bit behind the times in what technology, you know, was doing. I was actually, the turning point for me was my professor pulled up in the parking lot next to me, and he was driving this really old beat up car. And I was driving like, you know, like a 1 or 2 year old, really nice car. Cause I was making a lot of money in tech. It came very natural to me. It was easy.
Yeah.
And I was like, wow, what's this guy going to teach me?
You were Not in a negative light, but you were kind of hustling from a young age, right? In terms of
technology.
Yeah, but doing that, when I say that with the greatest respect, because you're doing that from the point of view of your passion, right? So you love computers, and you could see a value in being able to take that and actually make some entrepreneurship money even back then. So there's no harm in that. But yeah, that realization must have been pretty like visceral for you as well.
Yeah, it was. You know, he was doing what he did. You know, he had been around a while. He knew stuff that I would never learn because he had been in the industry much longer. But where I saw the industry going was not, you know, it wasn't COBOL back then. You know, that was, I kind of looked at that as out to pasture. And I knew that, you know, I was learning DOS and, you know, scripting. There was a lot of stuff to learn. That's actually when I started working with Novell NetWare. So I had a network at my house, actually in high school. A buddy of mine and I went to Princeton University to a ham fest. So a ham radio is what a ham fest is.
Okay.
It has nothing to do with bacon. And we went there and we found these 10 megabit laser Ethernet beams, which are about three or four foot long and about 8-inch by 8-inch cube like that. And it was a 10 megabit laser Ethernet beam, but they said they were broken. We bought them. We took them home for a couple hundred bucks. My buddy was really good with electronics. I had also taken electronics in high school. So we were, you know, pulled out the voltmeter and we were testing things. We repaired the power. It was just a power issue. I think someone had plugged it into like a 110 outlet or a 220 outlet instead of 110. And it didn't auto, you know, negotiate back then. So we fixed that and we mounted it on the roofs of our parents' house. And we had a 10 megabit laser Ethernet beam connecting our two homes.
That is that wild. Really cool. 10 megabit laser Ethernet. How, like, what, and what, like 93, 92? Like, what year?
I would say exactly right around then. It was right after high school, I think. Yeah.
Holy moly. You would have had probably one of the best internet setups of anyone almost anywhere in the world at that point, at that time. Outside of academia, right?
Yeah, back then we were still using BBSs, actually, is what we did, bulletin board systems. A friend of mine hosted one at his house. You know, he had like 8 phone lines and 8 modems. And so we were a bunch of, you know, super geeks.
So you were deep into it, right, in that real early days of the cusp of the internet. So when 95, 96, because I know obviously you started a business in 99, we'll get to that. But, you know, what were you doing in those middle years of the early internet days, the real sort of early days of internet?
So I think it was 1992. It was the year after I graduated high school and left college. I interviewed at a company, Cheyenne Software. Do you remember that name?
I don't know. I feel like I probably should, but tell me about them. Tell everyone else about them.
They're the original makers of ArcServe, the tape backup.
Oh, wow. Wow, okay. Then I probably should have known about them, right?
Yep. Cheyenne Software, they were headquartered out of Long Island, New York, where I grew up. About 20 minutes from my house in Roslyn is where they were. And I went in on the interview, and I was 19. So I was, you know, one of the youngest people they had ever interviewed. And the woman said, I see you have ArcServe on your resume. She said, where have you used ArcServe? I said, oh, well, I used it at my house to back up my Novell network. And I said, because a couple of years ago in high school, I had a hard drive crash and I lost a lot of data. I said, so I decided I never wanted to go through that. So at one of the swap meets, I bought a copy of ArcServe for like a dollar, I think. So I was basically admitting to pirating their software, which I didn't realize at the time.
Yeah.
And I bought a used tape drive, some used tapes, and I started backing up my network. And then what was really cool is because I had the laser Ethernet beam, we created VTLs. I don't even think they were called that back then, but I was doing offsite DR to my friend's house over the laser.
Whoa. Stop it, right? So you could have actually been the very first person to do Ethernet-based offsite DR of anyone in this planet, potentially. I don't know. I'm just putting it out there. But
it's a possibility, but definitely over laser Ethernet.
Definitely over laser, but just in general, because if you think about it, even back then, hell, think about it, even back in 2008, 9, whenever it was, people were still using dial-up and ADSL for their offsite backups.
This was prior to ADSL. We were still using phone lines at that point because ADSL came in a couple years later into my life. So she's interviewing me. I tell her that, and she says, I'll be right back. She comes back with like a half a dozen texts. And they start hitting me with questions. And I'm like, oh, yeah, you just unload the NLM from, you know, NetWare loadable module. You do this, you do that. And, you know, I was explaining how I used the software, how I troubleshoot it, how I did all my upgrades. And I had been using it for several years at that point. And needless to say, they hired me on the spot. I skipped the training session. Usually you come in, you do like a 3-month training to learn the product. I skipped that. I went right to the phones. And I was doing, you know, worldwide international support for their ArcServe tape backup product. About a year later, I went into the OS2 world. I became OS2 certified. I had already done my Novell network years ago.
So can I tell you a funny story about OS2? So
yeah, please.
I remember back in the Windows 3.1 sort of pre-95 days, my mate, who actually he was a really good friend of mine and really got me into computers more than anyone, I think, else, right? He was saying, oh, you got to check out this Linux thing. I'm like, oh, okay, cool, yeah. Where's the GUI? I can't do anything in here, but I think it's okay, whatever. Then he goes, okay, we'll try this. So I remember my computer, which was my pride and joy, he basically wiped whatever Windows version was on, and he put OS 2 Warp on it, right? And I remember loading it up, and it loaded, and I'm like, what the hell is this crap? Like, in my head, I was like, this is so bad. I'm like, dude, take it off. Get it off there, right? But that... And so I never ever touched OS 2 again until basically I realized that effectively even the operating system that I'm using today on my Mac is effectively what has become of that software anyway, right? But
yeah, I loved OS 2. It was
I didn't give it a chance basically. Like, how can you play Windows on it? How can you play Doom on it? Like, that was my question.
Well, I dual booted, so I used OS 2 for business stuff and then Windows for the game, and we did play a lot of games. Cheyenne Software, the average age was probably about 25 years old in the company. So while I was the youngest person they had ever hired at the time, there was a lot of young people there, and it was really cool. We played a lot of games, very cool atmosphere, you know, shorts and tank tops to work, very, very technology, like very, you know, Silicon Valley type thing for the 90s, which was cool. After that, I then went to McKinsey & Company, the management consulting firm in Manhattan. And that was my, you know, now my first New York City job. So traveling to the city, doing the train every day, which you're not from New York, but if you've come from Long Island to New York City, it's a big commute to do every day, driving to a train, to the city, to the subway. But it was a really cool company. I worked with some of the smartest people I've ever met in life. You know, these guys knew what they were doing. And that's where I really honed in on my network skills. But that's also where I got into networking on a high level. Like, in the beginning, I had a 2.5 megabit ARPANET network in my home back, you know, when I was a kid. so that I could network all my PCs. But when I got when I went to McKinsey and Company, we started doing worldwide networking. So I was managing and built out a network of about 143, I think it was, international locations, all over a frame relay network using. Back then, it was, I think it was Bay Networks, or no, Wellfleet router. So that's how I got into to IP and learned how to do routing, layer two, layer three. But what I did there with disaster recovery was they needed a DR plan. That was like a new thing. And I'm like, well, I've done this. So so I was lead on that project, and I interviewed SunGard and IBM Recovery Services. And IBM had a really nice facility. I think they still do. In New York, in Sterling Forest. And it was just beautiful location, you know, overlooking a lake up in the mountains. And it was the best, the most beautiful DR site I'd been to versus some of the other ones that were more, you know, in this, in a commercial type atmosphere.
Yeah.
So that's not why we picked them, but we picked them because we did use a lot of IBM products at the time. So I built out DR for the entire network side of things.
Okay.
There was another team who did all the AIX and all the IBM specific stuff. So I built that DR with IBM for McKinsey and Company. Then after I left there, I started my first company, and that was GTEL Networks, which was essentially, that was 1999. And essentially what I wanted to do was I wanted to take all of my years of IT experience, all of my DR experience, and put together a flat rate package for small businesses. And we came up with what we called the fixed price agreement. And it was a flat rate, all you can eat for your company. Each company had their own, you know, rate that we'd specify, but it encompassed everything. So from help desk to onsite to upgrades, et cetera, you know, excluding just the cost of basically hardware and licensing.
Yeah. And this is in 2000, right? So this didn't really come into... Or 99, right? So this didn't really come into play until probably 10 years later was when it was really become popular as an MSP. That's what you did. You offered the fixed price contracts per head, per user, whatever it was. So it wasn't the norm back then. Was it just ad hoc situations back then for the situation? Or
it was completely new. It was something that I had a business coach at the time who was a customer of mine from my previous, you know, employment. And he said he was actually teaching CPAs how to not charge by the hour and instead charge a flat rate for all you can do as a CPA. And he said, you can do the same thing. There's no difference. He goes, instead of you charging hourly like everyone else does, differentiate yourself. And we called it an FPA, the fixed price agreement. So it was about a decade ahead of our time for the MSP. Yeah, but it worked great.
Yeah, good stuff. I was going to ask, how do you, you've kind of almost answered it there, but what was your transition from being geek tech networking to wanting to start a business? How did you make that jump? What was the realization you had to start the company?
Yep. So I'd always wanted to be an entrepreneur. It was even back in grade school, I have an autobiography that I wrote in like the eighth grade that says by the age 25, I'll be an entrepreneur. I'll own at least one business. I had laid out that map, you know, in grammar school. And, you know, you kind of forget about it, but it helps the point, it reinforces the point that if you write things down, it'll help them come to fruition. And I had basically written down a lot of that, you know,
visualization. Visualization. And also that's a more tactile version of a visualization. I just watched the Arnold documentary and he talks about visualization quite a bit in that documentary.
Yeah. I'll have to see that. Yeah, so I'd always wanted to, and I had always been already. So like I said, at 12 years old, I was building and assembling computers. So I was an entrepreneur. You know, even before that, I delivered, you know, papers as a kid. So I was always, you know, hustling to work. But I loved technology. You know, it came really easy. And that's where starting this firm, I said, you know, this is, you know, time for me to go out on my own. I've gotten a good about 5-6 years of, you know, corporate experience in two very different companies. And I decided to start up on my own. And I did it without any investment. I spent a few hundred dollars to incorporate, and that was it. I was, we were within a year a $1 million company, so it was a pretty good start.
That is a very good start. Did you have any anchor customers there? You must have had a few customers on the boil there, or were they all net new from when you decided to start the company?
They were. I knew a lot of people. I didn't have any customers, but because of all the people I knew that I had done work with over the years, I reached out to them all. I still had all of my ArcServe experience. That was still a predominant, a piece of software in the market back then. It was, I think, Legato and ArcServe were the two top ones. So I basically just, called around to friends and got introduced to people who needed IT support. And in the late 90s, early 2000s, this was all, still very new. There were no MSPs. There was no organized business for the small business. It was just a lot of one-man consulting firms like myself. I grew it up to, maybe half a dozen employees, within a year or so.
Yeah. So, okay. So that time frame overlaps a little bit with Continuity Centers, right? This has all been you yourself. And so how does Continuity Centers come into play? Because Continuity Centers itself was started around 2000, right?
2000, yep. So in 2000, early 2000, I had met three gentlemen who wanted to start a business continuity site. And their idea was we open up locations that have offices built out. Desks, chairs, phones, PCs, printers, everything you need that if something happens to your building, you send them to our facility and we'll get you back in business. And that was their conceptual idea, but they had no idea how to implement the technology portion. So I said, I can do that. So they originally, the way they started it is they started the company and subcontracted the work to me, all IT work. So okay. I built out the network, I built out services. And that's really how the IT part of Continuity Centers came about. Was a customer, basically one of the services was you bring in your tapes once a week, once a month, whatever you want. You store them at our facility and we would quarterly, annually, monthly, we would take all those tapes, put them in and run restores and recover your entire environment. Something that most customers never do. They never tested their tapes. They just back them up and, hope they work. So our service was basically tape restoration validation. We would take all your tapes, restore them, get your environment up and running. Your people would come in and sit at the desks that we built out and you could run your company for the day and see it work. So that's how disaster recovery as a service came about for us. This was well before DRAS was, a term
even,
back
even
then.
A thing, yeah. So, okay, so just so I've got that in my head. So you started your company and then the Continuity Centers guys effectively brought you on as a consultant outsource. So were you still kind of doing that initial company under the guise of Continuity Centers, or were you working for Continuity Centers outright and had gotten rid of the company or sold off the company?
So everything was still, GTEL was a subcontractor to Continuity Centers for about a year. And about a year into the relationship, when the finances was, 80% revenue was being subcontracted to GTEL and only maybe 20%, for the seats was staying there. That's when the partners approached me and said, this is your game. they said this was a neat idea, but we see you running this and taking over. And basically we worked out a deal where I bought the three of them out. And we did a couple of year payment plan and I bought them out over the following years, but effective immediately, as soon as the buyout started, I became 100% owner and operator of it, of Continuity. So that's
and
where
was that through the 2000s up to 2010?
The first partner, I think I bought out in 2002 and it ended in 2007. And then the second two partners started in 2004, 2005, and went to 2009 or 10. And then 2010 is when I actually sold off all of my old GTEL clients, the traditional fixed price agreement customers. I sold that business off to focus 100% on Continuity Centers.
Okay, so let's talk about that time around 2010. So obviously, I know I was well in it in 2010, understanding you know, the platforms that we had, the operating systems, the infrastructure, backup software, virtualization, storage, all that kind of game. So Continuity Centers, what services were you offering even back then in 2010?
So by 2010, and maybe a little bit before that as well, that's where people were buying and paying about $2,000, $3,000 a month for a T1 to get 1.54 megabits of bandwidth, you know, from you to us, dedicated point to point. And we would do real-time replication of your most mission-critical systems. One of the products we used back then was DoubleTake, which was the...
Love DoubleTake. Cut my teeth on a lot of DoubleTake products, yeah.
Yep, we were a DoubleTake partner for a bunch of years. And so we were doing the real-time replication. Again, it still wasn't called DRaaS yet. I don't think that was more like the late teens that term came about. But we were essentially doing disaster recovery as a service. So we would replicate all your systems to equipment that we owned. So we were doing multi-tenant type replication. Multi-tenant in that VMware we weren't using yet. I think that was like 2012 to 15 is when we started using VMware. And that revolutionized, you know, how we could do multi-tenancy. So DoubleTake, then we partnered with a company called Asigra, who does backup software. We were partner with them for a few years. And something I learned over the years is basically any software can do decent backup, you know, whether it was ArcServe, DoubleTake, whether it was replication or backup. There was a lot of software that was good at getting the data from point A to B. But the magic of disaster recovery is the actual recovering from the disaster, getting the systems up and running. And, you know, we had 100-page run books of how to recover, you know, server A, you know, using DoubleTake or Asigra.
It wasn't
easy yet. It was very manual. You know, there wasn't a lot of scripting available for stuff like that. This is way before, you know, REST API calls and the ability to, you know, to script everything. So it was a lot of that. I was also at the time, I was the chair of the Long Island chapter of the Contingency Planning Exchange, which was an not-for-profit for bringing people together. We had, you know, we'd bring together a few hundred people, bring in speakers. It was mostly not technology. It was mostly business continuity planning. How do you keep your people running, your business running? And technology was, you know, a part of it, but a small part. So I got involved a lot in business continuity over those years. And one of the events we were hosting, it was at CA headquarters. So CA, formerly known as Computer Associates, we were in their headquarters. They were letting us use one of their venues. And a few of the guys came up and said, hey, you should check out our ArcServe D2D platform. Disk to disk is, you know, what the backup was. And that was our first foray into a product that had better capabilities than some others. And we partnered with them. It worked out well. What was neat about the relationship is I lived about 15 minutes from their headquarters. So they would bring me in on a quarterly basis, and I would sit down with the head of product and his entire development team, and we would whiteboard out exactly what I needed to do the software to do. And they would write software, you know, what I wanted.
That's brilliant access. You can't underestimate how important that is and how hard that is to actually get in any form of software relationship with the vendor, right? Being able to be as plugged in as that, as to say, hey, we need XYZ, and then for them to turn it around in a matter of weeks or whatever it might be.
Yeah, it was basically, I had the second largest software manufacturer in the world writing software for me. And even though it was publicly available to everyone, you still needed to know how to do it. And that's where, you know, at this point, we've been doing this for over a decade. I personally have been doing it for several decades. So creating a business model around it was where we, you know, we were really focused now on 100% DRaaS.
Yeah.
And then a few years later, I think it was, we had always looked at Veeam. We had looked at Veeam over the years, and Veeam was great at backing up VMs. That was what it was known for. But the multi-tenancy wasn't there. The DR wasn't there for what we needed yet. Until, basically when ransomware started to take over, the headlines and, you know, became, you know, everywhere. We had some brushes, you know, we had in 2019, we had a half a dozen customers hit with ransomware. And
okay. I was going to ask what time frame you were talking about, but yeah, you're talking about 2018, 19, when it really started to pick up, right? Yeah.
Yeah. Well, for us, it was 19 and it was six customers within like a 6 month period. And ArcServe, you know, while we did recover everyone and didn't lose data, it was not a warm and fuzzy feeling. It was a, you know, we were just as nervous as the customers were, and we didn't want to be in that position. And that's when we said, you know, what are we going to do different? What's the next best thing? And that's where we called our friends at Veeam again and said, hey, come on in and talk to us. We had Marty Williams and Chris Lynch and some people I used to work with, Wendy, that I used to work with at Cheyenne. So people I had known for, you know, over 20 years came in, we sat down and they talked about immutability. And one of my first questions to them when they walk in is they said, I don't want to back up to Windows anymore. I only want to back up to Linux. And that was one of the things I missed about Asigra. Asigra was a Linux backend. And I always felt secure that that's that and environment.
And that's not surprising given your background, right? Your networking, Novell, OS2. Like, I'm not surprised that that's where your kind of mind set.
Yeah, it just it's so much more secure and so much easier to secure than Windows. So that's when Marty had said, he said, oh, well, we have Linux and in V10 coming out in a couple of weeks, you know, actually in a few months, he said, we'll have immutability. And I was sold on the spot. So the end of 2019, we started testing V10 beta. By 2020, February, I think it was when it came out, we started a campaign to move every single customer over to Veeam. And
that's awesome.
The main reason is immutability as well as the Linux repository.
Awesome. And hey, I think, you know, from that point of view, you know, now you've got M365 backup services. You've got a whole bunch of backup services that you'd expect, but we've only got like about 7 minutes left. And I really want to talk about cloud IBR. Because I think this is a paradigm shift in terms of how someone is actually doing DR as a service, leveraging object storage, leveraging bare metal and Veeam technologies, but also to wrap that all around. And the reason why great things with great tech exists, you guys doing the legwork at the top to create a UI and an automation and provisioning and procurement process to be able to put it all together so a company can buy a full service off you without really putting and laying out a lot of money for a DR solution. So quickly go through what Cloud IBR is and a very, very quick overview of how it's put together, how it works, and what the value is.
Sure. So our good friends at Backblaze, who we had been partnering with for doing all of our offload of data from our primary storage over there to the capacity tier, as Veeam calls it, they actually came to me with the idea. They said, hey, we've been, you know, working on some Ansible scripts to do automated recovery, but we think this could be turned into a product. Is that something you think you can do? And it just so happened, a friend of mine who I hadn't spoke to for, you know, over a decade reached out, and he was always a developer. I said, what are you, you know, are you still developing? He said, yeah. So we put together a development team, and I had never done development. You know, he's been doing his whole life. We had daily scrums and sprints and all these different epics and Jira and all this stuff I'd never seen. And in no time, we were able to take basically decades of knowledge from my head and dump it into code and automate it via Ansible, REST API with Veeam, some Python, you know, basically all of the technologies that we need to use. There's a lot of PowerShell that Veeam uses. And we made the most simple, easy to use interface that we could think of. It's kind of like when you buy a home router and you're setting it up, it's got a few tabs that you go through to configure the settings. And what it allows a customer to do, and what we really wanted to target, was the customers who can't afford what we do. You know, DRaaS is not inexpensive. You know, it's thousands of dollars a month at minimum, and $10,000 to $20,000 to $50,000 a month is not out of the, you know, ballpark. People, you know, our customers do that. So we wanted to create something that any size company could get similar results. So it's not a replacement for DRaaS, but what it does is allows them to go in, they enter in their Backblaze bucket, their Veeam encryption keys, their VLANs, default gateways, some VPN accounts, and they buy that. It's $99 a month for the entry level version. It gets them access to the software, and they, anytime they want, they click recover now, and it could be a test or a real recovery. And what the software does is it reaches out to PhoenixNAP, who we use for the bare metal infrastructure. We provision X number of servers for them. One is a Windows server. We install Veeam on it. The other one is ESXi host. And we stand those up, all scripted and automatic. And we add their Backblaze bucket, scan it with Veeam, and start restoring all their servers onto the bare metal.
Yeah, wow. And I think this is, I mean, obviously it's something that sounds simple, but to put it all together, that's the magic and the innovation, right, that you guys have been able to bring to market, because there hasn't been too many that have been able to put it together like this and actually offer the service as fluently as what you guys have. So, you know, very quickly, why do you think you guys were able to get it? I mean, you mentioned the years of experience in your head, but yeah, maybe just, yeah, how did you crack it?
So, you know, as one of the terms I tell people for years, it's kind of a play on disaster recovery, is I'm a recovering geek. So I'm not just a geek, but I'm, you know, in the phases of recovery from being a geek. Yeah. And it's knowing what those small businesses and mid-sized businesses need, as opposed to what I want to create for them. So because I've been delivering this service for decades, and I'm hearing from them what it is they want, what it is they need, I already knew the requirements. I already knew what would make it simple for them, versus a bunch of really smart people just sitting in the room and saying, let's make a product that does X, Y, Z. And we go through that internally. You know, I have some brilliant people that are creating all this, and they're like, oh, we could do this, we could do that. I'm like, no, let's just keep it simple. Let's do what the small businesses want. We can always make it more complicated, but let's start with something that gets you back in business. And that's what the product does, basically, is it recovers your environment with one click, gives you VPN, sends out encrypted emails to all your, you know, employees with their credentials. So it's DR in a box for a company who's not looking to spend thousands of dollars a month.
And the key part of this, and I think the thing that's made this possible, is the rise of bare metal services, right? Like what PhoenixNAP has offered. I had Sushi Cloud on here late last year now. The rise of bare metal services against the public hypervisors has meant that you just don't buy a VM anymore. You can buy a whole server because the relative consumable cost of that has come down. But also, more importantly, the ability for the automated part of the bare metal to be exposed to a business like yours has become a reality. And so you guys have tapped into the APIs that PNAP offer to be able to build this with your own IP together with Veeam, together with Backblaze, and put it all together as one packaged bit of software. That's the magic in it, right? But I feel like the bare metal part is the part that we've been waiting for in the industry for a while. So in about 30 seconds, tell us a little bit about the bare metal aspect of this.
So, you know, we could do it virtually, but the nice part about doing it with bare metal is it gives the end user the ability to pay zero throughout the year. You know, so they have zero costs because the hardware is just sitting there and you can use it anytime you want. So you only pay for it when it's brought up, as opposed to with DRAS and VM, you need to, you know, in order to commit to having that equipment available for you, you're paying that fee throughout the year. So here we're just using inventory that's there and ready, you know, ready for the taking. You only pay for it when you use it. It's been a great partnership with PhoenixNAP. You know, they have, you know, the inventory to handle, you know, hundreds and hundreds of recoveries. So it just made it, you know, easier than using, you know, virtual.
Yeah. And I think that's the beauty of it. So you've put together an amazing service. We didn't really dig into it as much as I wanted to, but I think the point is that DR as a service, you've kind of evolved this from your career. You started all the way back with the lasers, you know, the Ethernet. You've done this through Novell, into your Sigra days, and then into that first managed services company that you had, and the early days of Continuity Center. But this is the next evolution of that. So I love your evolution. I love the fact that you're so passionate about this space, and it's been with you since you were a young kid, right? But yeah, I'm going to put a few notes down with regards to Continuity Centers. Just as a final reminder, if you love great things with great tech, please head to the website, gcwgt.com, or gcwgtpodcast. This has been episode 70 of Great Things with Great Tech. Thanks, Greg, and thank you to Continuity Centers.